Pull up a chair. I want you to picture a map of the South Pacific, spread out flat on a plotting table in a Quonset hut on Guadalcanal. It's April of 1943. The air inside that hut is thick enough to chew, hot, wet, smelling of mildew and cigarette smoke and hot radio tubes. And a handful of pilots are leaning over that map, doing the kind of arithmetic that makes your mouth go dry, because they've been handed a problem that, on paper, doesn't close. And the answer to that problem is going to change the war. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar where we pull the old stories down off the shelf and dust them off. Today we're talking about a mission the planners called Operation Vengeance, the longest fighter interception attempted up to that point in the war, and the airplane that made it possible, the twin-boom twin-engine bird the Germans called the fork-tailed devil, the Lockheed P-38 Lightning. Stay with me, this one's got everything. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private, pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and that's really the whole point, isn't it? You put that coin in a young pilot's hand, and 40 years later he can still tell you exactly what the air smelled like the morning he soloed. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. If you've earned it, wear it all, right? Back to that hut on Guadalcanal. Here's where it gets interesting. On the 14th of April, 1943, American codebreakers intercepted and decoded a Japanese naval message. Now, the Japanese didn't know it, but the United States Navy had cracked their operational code, the one the histories called JN-25. And this particular message was a gift from heaven. It was an itinerary, a minute-by-minute schedule for an inspection tour by Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. You know that name. Yamamoto was the commander-in-chief of the combined fleet. He was the architect, the man who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. He'd studied at Harvard, he'd been a naval attaché in Washington. He knew America, and he'd warned his own government that waking the sleeping giant was a fool's errand. But when they ordered him to plan the strike, he planned the best strike he could. And on the American side, there was no name higher on the list. None. And now here was his calendar. Decoded and sitting on a desk on April 18th. He would fly from Rabaul down to Balalay Airfield near Bougainville to visit the troops. The message gave the departure time. It gave the arrival time. It even noted that the admiral was famously, almost fanatically, punctual. You could set your watch by the man. So the question went up the chain, and it went up fast. All the way up, by most accounts, to the Secretary of the Navy. And there's good reason to think President Roosevelt himself knew. And the question was simple and it was cold. Do we go after him? There were arguments against it. Big ones. The biggest was the secret itself. If American fighters suddenly showed up in exactly the right patch of empty sky at exactly the right minute, 400 miles from home, the Japanese might figure out that their code was broken. And that code was worth more than any one man. So the cover story was already being built before the airplanes ever left the ground. The word put out was that Coast Watchers, those brave souls hiding in the jungle, had spotted the movement, a little bit of misdirection to protect the crown jewel. But the decision came down, go get him, and that's when they walked over to the map. And that's when the arithmetic got ugly. Because here's the trouble. Yamamoto's flight would pass near Bougainville, and Bougainville, from the American fighter strip on Guadalcanal, was a long, long way to intercept him and not tip your hand. You couldn't fly the direct route, straight up the island chain, because that route ran right past Japanese airfields and lookout posts the whole way. Fly that, and you'd be spotted. And the admiral's airplanes would just turn around. So the fighters would have to go the long way. Way out over open water, low out of sight of land. In a big dogleg to come at the target from the seaward side where nobody would be looking. And when you added it all up, the round trip came to something like 1,000 miles. The intercept point alone was more than 400 miles out. Better than 430 by most reckonings. Now stop and think about that. 1943, no GPS, a wet compass and a clock, and your own eyeballs, flying just above the wave tops for hours to stay under any radar and out of sight. Which means no help from the wind at altitude and no landmarks, none, just gray water and glare. And you had to arrive at a single point in the sky, hundreds of miles from anywhere, at the exact 2 or 3 minutes when one particular airplane would pass through it. Miss the timing by 10 minutes and you've flown 1,000 miles for nothing, miss the navigation by 20 miles and you never even see him. There was only one airplane in that theater that could even attempt it. And that's our star today, the P-38 Lightning. Let me tell you about this machine, because she was like nothing else in the sky. Kelly Johnson designed her for Lockheed, the same Kelly Johnson who'd later run the Skunk Works and give us the U-2 and the Blackbird. And when the Army asked for a high-altitude interceptor back in the late 30s, Johnson gave them something that looked like it came from the future. Two engines, Allison V-12s, turbo-supercharged, one in each of two long booms that ran back from the wing. The pilot sat in a little pod, a nacelle slung in the center between them, with a nose wheel underneath, which was rare as hen's teeth back then. And all the guns, 450 caliber machine guns and a 20mm cannon, were packed into that nose, right in front of the pilot. Now think about why that matters. On a single-engine fighter with guns out in the wings, you had to harmonize those guns to converge at one point a couple hundred yards out. Fire outside that range and your bullets crossed and spread. But on the Lightning, the guns fired straight ahead in a tight parallel stream that stayed deadly out to a long way. Pilots said it was like aiming a garden hose. You didn't have to guess the range. You just pointed the nose and the target came apart, and she was fast, and she had legs. That was the thing that mattered most on April 18th. With drop tanks hung under the wings, the Lightning could go and go and go. She had the range to fly out over that ocean, loiter, fight, and come home. No other fighter on that island could do it. Not the Wildcats, not the Warhawks, just the P-38. The men who'd fly her came out of the 339th Fighter Squadron, and some attached pilots, part of the outfit on Guadalcanal. The mission commander was a major named John Mitchell, and Mitchell is the man I want you to remember, because everybody remembers the shooters, and we'll get to them. But Mitchell is the one who solved the arithmetic. He's the one who made it close. Mitchell sat down and worked the whole problem backward. He picked the dogleg course, four or five separate legs, each one a different heading, out over the water and around. He calculated the headings. He figured the timing so tight that he wanted to arrive at the intercept point just 1 minute before Yamamoto got there. 1 minute of slack after 435 miles of dead reckoning over open ocean. That's not flying. That's threading a needle in the dark while somebody spins you around, and Mitchell knew his compass wasn't good enough for it, so he did something clever. He got hold of a Navy ship's compass, a good one, and had it mounted in his airplane, because the standard aircraft compass just wasn't precise enough for the job he had to do. That's the level of detail we're talking about. A man scrounging a better compass because the margin for error was measured in single minutes. They split the force. Most of the Lightnings, Mitchell's group would fly top cover. Climbing up high to fend off the swarm of Japanese fighters, everybody expected to come boiling up from the airfields nearby, and a small group, the Killer Flight, would go in low and do the actual shooting. Four airplanes in that Killer Flight, with a couple of spares in case somebody had trouble. And they did have trouble, right off the bat, morning of the 18th. They line up on the strip at Guadalcanal, engines warming, that fuel and oil and coral dust smell hanging over everything, and as they roll, one Lightning blows a tire on takeoff, another can't get fuel to feed from its drop tanks and has to abort, just like that before they've even left the island. The Killer Flight is down from 4 to 2, two airplanes, to do the actual job. The two men left holding the mission were Rex Barber and a pilot named Tom Lanfear. Remember those two names? Barber and Lanfear. Because 60 years of argument is going to hang on them. So off they go, 16, 18 Lightnings out over the water, dropping down low, right down on the deck, wave hopping. For over 2 hours they held those headings, radio silent, nobody saying a word, sweating in the heat, watching the fuel, watching the clock, trusting Mitchell's numbers and that borrowed ship's compass. 2 hours and change of nothing but water and glare and the drone of those Allisons. Now here's the part that still gives me chills. They came up on the coast of Bougainville right on the money, and Mitchell, or one of his pilots, looks up, and there they are. Right on schedule, right where the arithmetic said they'd be. Two Japanese bombers, Mitsubishi G-4Ms, the type the Allies called Betty, carrying the Admiral and his staff, with 6-0 fighters flying escort above them. Yamamoto's punctuality killed him. The man was exactly on time, and so were the Americans. After a 1,000-mile horseshoe over open ocean, the two formations arrived at the same speck of sky within about a minute of each other. I've been flying my whole life, and I still don't entirely believe that navigation was possible, but it happened.
Mitchell's top cover climbed to take on the Zeros and hold off whatever came up from the fields. And the Killer Flight, those two Lightnings, Barber and Lanfear, dropped their tanks and turned in on the bombers. The Zeros saw them late. The escort came diving down. Lanfear broke up and into the fighters to break up their attack. Barber bored straight in on the bombers. He got in behind one of the Bettys, opened up with that hose of 50 caliber and cannon fire, and pieces started coming off it. The bomber's engine caught fire. It rolled, and it went down into the jungle, trailing black smoke. The other Betty ran for the water, got hit and went down into the sea off the coast. The whole shooting match, after all that planning, after 1,000 miles, lasted about a minute. Maybe two. Yamamoto was in the bomber that went down in the jungle. A Japanese search party reached the wreckage the next day and found the Admiral still strapped in his seat, thrown clear of the fuselage, a white-gloved hand on his sword. gone. The Lightnings turned for home. They'd lost one airplane and one pilot on the American side. The rest made that long, fuel-critical crawl back across the water to Guadalcanal, some of them coming in on fumes, and when they got down, the word was already spreading. They got him. They actually got him. Now, here's where it gets complicated, and I'd be lying to you if I told it any other way. Both Rex Barber and Tom Lanfear claimed the bomber that carried Yamamoto. And for the rest of their lives, and I mean for decades, that argument never died. The Air Force eventually split the official credit, and neither man was ever happy about it. Historians have pored over the Japanese records, the position of the wreckage, the testimony of the one escort pilot who survived, the damage on the recovered airplane. A lot of the careful modern study comes down on Rex Barber's side, but I'm not here to settle a fight that two good men took to their graves. I'll just tell you this, it took every single one of them. It took Mitchell's navigation and the top cover holding off the Zeros and both shooters going in. Take away any piece of it and the Admiral flies home. That was a team that pulled off something the arithmetic said couldn't be done. And the code stayed secret. The Japanese did investigate whether their cipher had been broken, but they convinced themselves it was Coast Watchers and bad luck, and they kept using that code. The cover story held. So what do I want you to take from all this, sitting here decades later? Two things. First, the airplane. The P-38 gets overshadowed sometimes. Everybody swoons over the Mustang, and she deserves it, and the fighters that dogfought over England get all the movies. But the Lightning did things nobody else could do. She had the range, and the reliability, and the punch to reach 435 miles out over empty ocean, and do a job of surgery. Two engines meant that when one Allison took a hit way out over the water, and they did, a lot of P-38 pilots came home on the other one. That second engine was the difference between a widow and a homecoming. Never forget what that airplane could carry a man through. And second, the navigation. We fly today with a moving map that paints our position on a screen to within a few feet, and thank goodness we do. But I want you to remember John Mitchell, hunched over a plotting table with a borrowed ship's compass and a wristwatch, working the wind and the headings by hand, and hitting a point in the sky 435 miles away within 1 minute of his target. That is the craft of flying, stripped down to its bones. That's dead reckoning at the absolute peak of what a human mind can do. When your instructor makes you plan across country by hand, when he takes the magenta line away and hands you a plotter and an E6B and says, find the airport, this is the tradition he's handing you. It goes straight back to that hut on Guadalcanal. Respect it. The details today came from the wartime records of the mission and the men who flew it, from the histories of the 339th Fighter Squadron, and from years of careful research by historians who've tried to sort out exactly what happened in that 1 minute over Bougainville. The arguments are still going. That's part of what keeps these stories alive. You can find us at RadioHangard.com, and next time you're on a long cross country and that little airplane on the screen is telling you exactly where you are, spare a thought for the man with the ship's compass who found his way to the far side of the ocean and back with nothing but numbers and nerve. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.